Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment.
When you think of agriculture, or better still, think of its sane alternative agroecology, you think of food production and what you eat. You might also think about all the ways in which agriculture and what we eat creates health problems and ecological problems and climate problems and social problems and the need, the urgent need, to do things differently. But when thinking about where food comes from, you should also consider where your clothes come from. I'm not talking about their manufacture, whether in distant lands or not. I want to direct your attention to the material out of which the clothes you're wearing right now came from, whether from an oil well or the soil. And if from the soil, was it grown with the same kind of concern for health, ecology, climate, and society as the food you eat? There are people actively engaged in creating a new mode of production for the fibers grown to weave the cloth out of which our clothes are made. A new concept has been introduced to capture this new mode of production, the fiber shed. My guest today is Rebecca Burgess, Executive Director and founder of the nonprofit organization FiberShed. Rebecca is an indigo farmer, author, and community organizer whose work has focused on natural dye processes and regenerative agriculture, textile education, and public speaking. Rebecca Burgess, welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It is an honor to be here today.
Oh, thanks. Your organization currently is focused on supporting wool producers as a fiber. So using that kind of fiber, describe what a wool fiber shed is and how it works.
Well, the reason that our organization is focused on wool, amongst other fibers, but we have a heavy focus on wool, it's because it's an already existent, abundant material that's being produced in our state, particularly in Northern California. California is the largest wool producer in the country. And in Northern California, because of the microclimates, if you think about 400 specialty crops coming out of our state on an annual basis for everything from what we drink to eat to wear, these microclimates are the basis for a lot of diversity in breeds, very ancient breeds to some kind of more modern breeds that have adapted to our climate. And because of the coast, Central Valley, the Sierra foothills, all of these microclimates produce this incredible preponderance and diversity of fiber. That is useful for so many non-toxic, very clean soil, soil-based durable goods and clothing. So we focus on wool because, like I said, it's an existent material, but our organization, just for everyone to understand, we're very focused on all that you can grow in an agroecological model within a strategic geography to not only create texture, but also color. So we focus on natural dye growing. We also focus on flax for linen production, which is going on in the Chico area right now. A lot of research on bringing it back as a winter crop in the Sierra foothills. We also focus on organic and biodynamic cotton. We have the only biodynamic cotton grower in the country right here in our Yolo County, Capay Valley, Sally Fox. And we also are very interested in hemp production as it becomes, as the regulatory framework is solidified with the state. We look forward to applying for permits and growing it for clothing production. So we're really interested in the plants and the animals. So the four-leggeds and how those four-legged species integrate with crops, which is really the agroecological model that we're focused on. So a wool fiber shed, I would say, is, you know, it would be in tandem with a wool, biodynamic cotton, hemp, flax, madder root, indigo, marigold, fiber shed. It's about integration as much as we can devise that integration.
When I think of fiber shed or a something shed, I start with what a watershed is, which I take it is the inspiration for this notion of a fiber shed. And the notion of a watershed is that any drop of water which falls in that area ends up coming out of that watershed or being collected in that watershed. So from that standpoint, what is kind of the dynamic description of a fiber shed that gives us a sense, the same kind of sense or a similar kind of sense as to what a watershed is, and perhaps contrast that with the dominant mode of production of wool or some other fiber?
So it is true. I very much looked at watershed science, hydrology. I spent a lot of time at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center under this study of what Brock Dolman calls the basins of relation, which is a watershed is a basin of relationship, which has cultural and scientific implications both.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So I feel as though that the fiber shed, if you were to look at it as a basin of relationship, it's really a strategic geography that within that can produce the materials, the textures and the colors to clothe a population. And so that geography, that strategic geography, that's the strategic is the operative word. I'm interested in how intimate a geography you can create. How close to where you live, how sensitive can one become to all of the resources and managing our resources, if we're talking about working landscapes, for instance, for things like water holding capacity. So we intersect, a fiber shed intersects with a watershed from a hydrologic perspective, I think. We're interested
yes.
in developing. Yeah, you know, so soil organic matter increases yield wonderful water holding capacity results. And we're very focused on when sheep are grazing in orchards or in vineyards, or they're munching down a cover crop that you've planted in advance of your indigo planting, that you're actually through the integration of the animal, the dye plant, the food crop, the fiber animal, that you're building soil organic matter in your watershed. So I think of these layers of watershed health, fiber shed systems. When we think about sheds, you know, we're trying to become, again, reconnected, sensitive, and reverent for life-giving resources. And also noting that they're not just resources. I mean, they have a life to themselves, and honoring that kind
yes.
of reciprocity between things. You know, I remember going to Norway and studying some of their fungal community scientists who were using mushrooms for dyes for natural color.
Hmm.
And one of the scientists had just come out of the forest, and he was covered in moss and dirt. And I said, well, he said, oh, we were looking for these specific species of mushroom. And I said, oh, are you resource mapping? And he said, we don't think of it as resource mapping. These are life forms. They're not our resources. They're their own entity, and we are in relationship with them. So it's kind of like, you know, this intimacy that you create with a strategic geography, it starts to bring you into what I would call a closer right relationship. And right relationship to me is just about respect for that which is giving you something, figuring out how to give back to it.
Yes. Now, you're supporting wool producers, also known as shepherds. Why would they want to join your organization or join with you? So what draws people to be a member of the Fiber Shed organization?
Well, it begins, I think, with a regional economic development drive. A lot of those in agriculture right now who steward working lands have had a very difficult time making it financially in the commodity markets as they exist in the world today. And wool is often sent off, if it's a good quality, its highest level of economic gain for a producer was to put it into a commodity market auction, and it could get at best sent overseas to just be washed or, you know, modified into whatever value addition system that, you know, is basically a lot of these systems are seeded overseas. There's a handful of, you know, Pendleton wool mill remains, Bowman's washing facility in Texas, Chargier's in South Carolina is a wool top production facility. There's about three big players left in the entire United States at that scale that really can work with large scale producers and help them get their material made into something that you could wear on your skin as a non-toxic, biodegradable, technically compostable textile. But these producers don't, unless you're a very large scale producer, those three value chains that were left in the US that I just mentioned, they don't take small production, annual production of a wool clip. Like if you don't have thousands of sheep, it's very hard to move your material through that value chain. And for ranchers who have thousands of sheep, it's very expensive to build your own direct markets and move your own material through a value chain. A lot of producers with small flocks were having to ditch their wool, and that could mean storing it in the barn rafters for a few years, waiting till you have enough to maybe sell it into the commodity market, to get it to auction. I mean, even getting it to auction and having your sheep sheared is, it's a very expensive thing in terms of gas and time. And so ditching wool can also mean leaving it in a ditch. Which is something I've seen, and it was rather heartbreaking to see a sheep producing so much material in a year, then getting an annual haircut, feeling very liberated by that haircut, and then all this beautiful protein fiber just going to waste. So I think what drives people to join is those economic conditions that I've described, which are that even if you're a large producer, it's still difficult to find markets. If you're a small producer, you have to be very savvy to develop these markets. And so what we're trying to do is develop a community of people who all can offer each other different things, meaning we connect people who hand spin yarns all the way to mills who can produce tens of thousands of pounds of yarn per month. We're trying to build these relationships for a gradient of producers, whether you have two sheep or 10,000 sheep. And through building these communities of producers, you know, that we're starting to elevate the conversation of big farmer, small farmer. It's more like people who are on the land. What do you need? And so we've been building relationships with brands. As an organization, we do presentations to major brands who work with maybe synthetic materials and are looking for a natural alternative. And we bring the story of the farmer straight to the boardroom, you know, and that's, I think, what is transforming the drive for membership is people are saying, hey, let's work with an organization who wants to represent us directly. And so what we do, if we do our job well, is we actually just help the farmer or the rancher build a direct market with the brand. And that's when you start to see that farmer being able to actually afford to shear their sheep, or actually afford to be able to buy feed during a drought year, if that's what happens, because our climate is rapidly changing. So I'll stop there. But I think that's a lot of the drive that I've seen. I know there's other reasons people join, but I think that's, if I could umbrella it under regional economic development, that would probably be the first reason that I've noted.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I am talking today with Rebecca Burgess about her organization, Fiber Shed. And we were just talking about wool producers. It seems as though what you're describing is that these wool producers are very dedicated to a land ethic and a mode of production, and that you are helping them to survive in the market economy that we have. It's the capitalist economy that we have. But that in addition, to just doing what actually agricultural cooperatives help do with marketing product in a capitalist mode, but that there is a heavy emphasis on that land ethic and that agroecological approach to the production process itself, and that that no doubt becomes a part of the attraction for the product, for the wool product or other fiber product that's being produced. So I would guess that your organization does that kind of promotion as well, but not only with potential buyers, but also with potential producers or joiners themselves. So it happens at both ends, that you support the agroecology as a marketing tool, but also as to further develop that land ethic. Is that close?
Oh, very, very well said. We do work with the bridge we're building between the brands and the land-based community is one that where everyone shares an ethic to restore the soil. And the producers are interested in building the soil because we've been in an education process with our producer community for really since 2011, annual symposiums where we're bringing scientists and agroecologists and brands and designers. But really, we've brought in that scientific community to talk about climate change, soil loss, you know, being really honest about the future for land-based communities, which is we're all land-based communities, even if we're just consuming. You know, even if you live in a city, you're reliant on land-based communities for your meals and your shelter and et cetera. You know, when we look at the future of our climate in California now, I'm not really an optimist when it comes to climate change.
Join the club. We've been doing shows that are far from cheery.
It's exactly. So I think there's a state of urgency. Now, some of us are feeling the reality of you know, we're at the hockey stick graph part of the climate change.
Yes.
So as the hockey stick takes shape, it's turning people towards solutions. And I would say as humanity does that, there's a lot of false solutions, but this particular solution of soil health and drawing down carbon through plants into soil and then having those very carefully grazed so that those plants can regrow and capture more atmospheric carbon and keep building that soil, that's the narrative that we've brought both scientifically but also just actively. We've gone out and taken soil samples to know what we call soil carbon baseline is on these farms and ranches. So we actually have an active, very place-based understanding of the amount of carbon we are stewarding as a community of shepherds, farmers, rangeland managers. There's a sense of this is the carbon sink that we're managing. Now, how can we increase that carbon by 1%, 2%, 3%? And so we keep looking for those strategies. We've developed a host of them, and we actually, as we're talking to the brands, we're having a very strong economic conversation. We're saying this wool is, yes, it's important for you to be, you know, offering a non-fossil carbon-based fiber, but we also need the sale of these goods to include money that goes back to helping us change management practices so we are sinking a lot more carbon than we would without these practice changes into this soil. We need to draw down globally 136 billion tons of carbon if we have any chance. And I feel like this particular soil building, as I've said, it brings people to the same ground, quite literally. We all can share in this understanding of soil, its importance in our survival. And right now, its importance in building it so we can remove the atmospheric carbon. We call it decarbonizing the atmosphere and recarbonizing the soil.
The processes that you talk about have a lot to do with capturing carbon dioxide and lowering its emissions. But one of the issues that has come up in this kind of very odd conversation about how raising livestock is a bad thing because it contributes all this methane. It's the cow fart theory of global warming. My opinion happens to be that, first of all, it ignores the fact that the problem is industrial agriculture. It's not that cattle have gas or herbivores have gas. If cattle are raised on grazing, they don't have those digestive problems that are created when you put them on grains. But that aside, it further raises one of the problems cited is that all this methane is being produced, and methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So in that context, I wonder if you have anything to say about that methane dynamic that's part of the carbon cycle and what the practices that you're encouraging and promoting might do with regard to that very strong greenhouse gas.
So methane is it's 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide, but it's very short-lived. So the way that the scientific community understands nitrous oxide, methane, and carbon dioxide, they measure these greenhouse gases with a notation called CO2e. So if you're reading agency documents from the IPCC or the Healthy Soils Program or the Air Resources Board in California, you'll see all of the greenhouse gas equivalents. So carbon dioxide, CO2e, is taking in account of methane and nitrous oxide in the whole package of greenhouse gas emissions. And another, we have to note that the biggest now greenhouse gas right now is actually water vapor from all the evapotranspiration that's occurring from a heating planet.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the CO2e, when we do what we call biogeochemical life cycle assessment, we look at sheep on a landscape. Now, in California, these are grass-fed and finished animals. These are not animals that spend time in a CAFO. These are not animals that are contained in ways that a lot of people identify with industrial agriculture. Again,
now let me pause right there because you just said something that some folks may not know what it meant. A CAFO is a confined animal feedlot operation. If you ever drive down I-5 in California, you will see these are the famously huge and environmentally destructive operations where large numbers of animals are confined, as it says, and fed, and pile up huge amounts of waste. So that's what a CAFO is. So I apologize. Please go on.
So the sheep that we work with in California, just the way our system works, we can have these open range processes where animals are grazing on chaparral and grasslands, and they're moved seasonally with shepherds and guard dogs, and they're able to move through a system without what we would call the CAFO being necessary, which is feeding them in a contained unit. So back to the CO2e just for a moment. We did an analysis where we looked at, and this is with the biogeochemical lab at UC Berkeley. We worked with Dr. Marcia DeLange. People can email me if they want the life cycle assessment. Marcia now works at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And so it's a very reputable, first of its kind LCA, which is, how do we understand emissions? How do we understand our overall impact to the atmosphere? How are we contributing to climate change or not through these grass-fed and finished grazing systems for wool production? And we looked at the addition of, see, I mentioned we look at a lot of different practices so we can start drawing down carbon. And we looked at adding a half-inch layer of compost onto the rangelands, which are unirrigated systems where sheep can graze, where they generally graze. And these half-inch layers of compost put out onto the system in the fall, right before the rains come, ignite a state change in those rangeland systems. And we found that we could actually, through these slow-release fertilization practices via compost, help increase water holding capacity in these grasslands through the addition of compost. And through the increasing in water holding capacity, the grasses were growing longer into the season. When they're growing longer, they're capturing carbon for longer. When they're capturing carbon for longer, they're distributing more of that carbohydrate that they create out of atmospheric carbon to construct themselves right into the soil. And so we were seeing this whole state change occur with this little jump in the system through compost, and sheep were integral. This system was modeled as a grazed system. It had to be grazed for the life cycle assessment to work. And we took into account enteric fermentation, which is a belch or a fart. And all told, we were able to create a net negative impact system, meaning for every pound of wool, like so one of the demonstration ranches that we work with, for every pound of wool that comes off of a sheep, we've sequestered 6 to 9 pounds of carbon into the soil. So this is taking into account methane, nitrous oxide, and carbon dioxide as they relate to greenhouse gas intrusion into the atmosphere. So it's a CO2e measurement. And the last thing I'll say about methane, for those that want to look at this more, when we look at North American herbivore impact 60,000 years ago, there were more herbivores than there are today with modern industrial agriculture. It's really important for modern humans to understand that even though we have the CAFO and we have these horrific industrial systems to produce poultry and lamb and red meat of all kinds, yes, there are some bad things occurring and they need to change. But we've actually had more animal impact in our historic past than we have today. It's not necessarily the cow, it's where we're putting the cow. It's not so right. That's really what we have to start reevaluating. And methanotropes is what I wanted to mention. This is a bacteria that eats methane. And if you don't concentrate the manure, if you allow the animal to graze biomimetically, like the elk herd or the pronghorn antelope would, or, you know, even the woolly mammoths of the ancient times, these methanotropes have co-evolved to digest methane and eat it as a feedstock. So methanotropes do a lot to take out the impact of methane in the atmosphere, as long as we're allowing grazing to happen as it naturally would.
I'm going to have to take a brief musical break here. When I come back, I'll continue talking with Rebecca Burgess about her organization, Fibershed. Please stay tuned. You're in the right place. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Rebecca Burgess about her organization, Fibershed. Our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, has more information about this show and our archive of almost 700 shows, a free download of today's show, and free open access to all our shows at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Rebecca, how can listeners learn more about your work?
They can go to our website. It's www.fibershed.org. And we have a blog, and that generally posts stories of the farmers and ranchers and artists that we work with. And I think it's great if people want to learn more about the work that they go straight to the land and go for a site visit and see for yourself. There's a lot of opportunities to connect with our Fiber Shed community directly.
Great. And we'll have those links on our website in association with this interview. So you had a fashion show.
We did.
And what that brings up for me is how makes me wonder how the values embedded in fiber shed based production extend into the process of manufacturing clothing.
So just tactically, once we collect material from a landscape, from picking biodynamic organic cotton, or in the case of some of our projects, we've been able to harvest hemp, not in this state, but others where it's legal, and or shear a sheep or harvest our indigo. Once things leave the farm, we are focused on a system of value chain production that includes regionalization. So we want to create, and have been able to a degree, in the small amount of time we've been focused on regional economic development, we've been able to put mills, processing facilities back into our community. And this has been, you know, having a fashion show is a complete flowering of years of economic development work, feasibility studies, lots of Excel spreadsheets, and hundreds of hours of conference calls. So a fashion show is really, it's this really sensory rich moment where you're having a farm to table dinner, and the food you're eating and the fermented drinks you're drinking and the candles that are burning beautifully to light your meal are all from the same landscapes where the cloves have been grown, and the colors for those cloves have been grown. So we have this beautiful moment where people can see what the terroir of their land expresses itself as in clothing, which I call your first form of shelter and your food. But in terms of getting the value addition, how our ethic carries through from the farm to the skin, is that we're interested in bridging what I would call the neoliberal, neo-fascist divide of the U.S. political system, where we've seen that the global capitalist supply chains that have been based off of exploitation, which is I'm going to go get this thing made for the cheapest price I can. I'm going to make millions of units of this thing in an opaque supply chain and just sell it with, you know, semi-anorexic models running down a runway, and you're going to love it. And, you know, it's just exploitation from point A to point B to Z. That model really does rely on these very inexpensive inputs, whether that's a human input, a synthetic compound that's fossil carbon derived, which we're not paying the full price of until we take into account the cost of climate change. All of those opaque systems are something we are working ardently to ameliorate through transparency and regionalism. So we want to bring this idea of the global frictionless economy, where capital just moves wherever it wants, whenever it wants, that we bring that money home and we start rebuilding infrastructure and communities in our home communities, where there's a real need for jobs that are not just technology based. We actually, and it's, you know, running a wool mill or a cotton gin does take some savvy, but the technology.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's an old school manufacturing job.
Yes, it is.
But you can put solar panels on that wool mill and run it carbon neutrally. And so we're interested in how we bring back these livelihoods. I don't really call them jobs, because I think, you know, when I've visited cotton mills in the South, east where there's a few family-owned mills that still exist, I've talked to the owners who say, you know, this was a fifth-generation project for my family to make cotton yarn. This was a heritage project. You know, we were proud of the clothes we could make for our community. And that kind of pride in creating a basic human necessity is what I'm interested in revitalizing in our home community. So we have three new mills, actually, in the Northern California Fiber Shed as of this year.
Oh, because I saw that one of the things that I noticed in some place in the literature of yours is that there's one mill whose name I've completely forgotten that was over by Sacramento someplace, in that area in the Central Valley. Houston Textiles. Yeah, that's a name I recognize, but now you've got more.
Yes, so we have these family-owned projects. So Ryan and Kat Houston and Ryan's mother, Laura, and Ryan's sister and brother-in-law, this is a real family affair to bring what we call the weaving mill, the traditional weaving mill, back. California used to have 12 vertically integrated mills in the state where we were actually making cloth from what we grew from our own land base. And around 1892, when the transnational or trans-Pacific railway line came in, a lot of our garments were undercut by labor in the Southeast that was still very, very like post-slavery exploitation pricing. So to have Ryan on the West Coast, you know, in an area where denim was popularized through coal mining culture, to have a non-extractive ethos attached to a mill that's actually producing homegrown denim with plant-based dyes and certified organic cotton, it's a real paradigm shifter. And he's a veteran. He's been to war for oil. He knows what that imperial system looks like and feels like. And he has come home to become what he calls, you know, a nation builder in the right way. So I think it's very powerful to watch human beings in our community transformed when they start identifying with a livelihood. And the other two mills that have opened, Matt and Sarah Gilbert, are from a sheep shearing family, and they've opened the Mendocino Wool and Fiber Mill in Ukiah. And the other mill that has opened is the Valley Oak Wool Mill in Winters, California, and it's run by Markale Williams, a single woman running a wool mill. It's fantastic.
Yay!
Yes.
One of the things that I did want to follow up with you on and discuss is how this local agroecologically focused production process develops with other, call it place-based production processes, and the transformation of the fibers into cloth is one example of those. But then there is the integration with food systems, and related to that, and how animals are actually grazed, how are those herds integrated into other agroecological processes, into food production, for example, and other production processes that people are engaged in that are place-based processes, that are ways of life. Hmm.
Well, one example, I mean, one of the reasons why we have a lot of wool that hasn't historically had a place to go is because the sheep, so as of the, you know, after nylon and polyester hit the market in the 1950s, we really saw ranchers, you know, a rancher in Mendocino County, I heard once interviewed say, you know, with the check that I would receive from 1 year's wool clip, I could buy more land to graze my sheep. Right now, a wool clip check would barely cost, it would barely pay for, like I said, the cost of shearing the animal. So how animals have been raised in California since mid-20th century has been really for lamb meat production. And so those grass-fed and finished animals have gone into the lamb market. And so when you eat a protein like a grass-fed and finished animal, that animal, if it's a sheep or in our case in California, it's mainly sheep. But these animals produce beautiful, beautiful fibers. So you could eat a protein and you could wear a protein. Now, I'm sure there's many listeners who are very sensitive to the harvest of animals, and that's not part of their value system. So I could also talk about the integration of the wheat cycle with cotton. So in our area, we have the ability to grow organic wheat in the winter, and there's a huge resurgence in the grain, local grain movement, and there's new mills propping up, so you can buy heirloom grains direct and get a grain CSA. Well, one of our grain CSAs is tethered to an organic cotton production system. So in the summer, cotton is grown interspersed with black-eyed peas, milo, and teff. In the winter, wheat is then put into that same field. So through these crop rotations and through co-planting black-eyed peas with cotton, you see nitrogen fixing occurring while the crop is being grown. And again, that's the farm of Sally Fox in the Quépe Valley, who's modeling this stacked function landscape. And Sally brings her sheep in to graze down her wheat. She actually brings them in early on. They graze early on in the season, and the wheat comes back very vigorously. And then she grazes them through the system after the wheat's been harvested, and they graze it down again. And so you can actually use animals in these systems to get what they need, which is nutrients and live carbohydrates to make their proteins, but they're also able to mitigate a farmer's reliance on tillage as much. That's what we're pushing right now.
Yes.
How do we move away from the heavy tilled system but retain organic status while building soil carbon? It's a new field of agroecology to honor a low input system, a biodynamic system where everything you need comes right from that land. So the animals are really critical to that. I've seen very few farmers who can produce even a vegetarian diet without animal inputs. You know, animal inputs come from blood meal, bone meal. There's a lot of mineralization that happens for a vegetarian diet from livestock. You know, it's kind of like we have to just be really honest about the role that animals play. So even if you didn't want to harvest an animal and eat it, you could still wear the wool. And there's one flock called Heartfelt Fiber Farm in Sonoma, and they don't harvest the animals for meat, but they do spin all of the fibers and make sweaters. So I honor that everyone's at a different place in their understanding of agroecology related to animal agriculture. But personally, I've seen the vitality that comes from a human being that is eating and wearing from the same landscape. And I think it's a really powerful vision for our future. And I think it's very it's very ancient stuff. We're just bringing it back.
So it seems. Let me ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett, and I am talking today with Rebecca Burgess about Fibershed and the organization of the same name. So this is very exciting information about moving toward what I'd call production and life at a human scale. Mm. And the integration of different production systems that are clean and healthy. When you were talking about the grazing system, this is almost back to the concept of the fiber shed itself. How grazing integrates with natural systems. I mean, my experience of herders is that they move around a lot, that they move into an area, they graze. In fact, where I live right now, one of the people up here has a small herd of sheep. And what they do is we have grassy hills, and they take the sheep around, and that's where they graze, that they lower the fire danger, just in the course of tromping around and pooping and whatnot, they add to the vitality of those biotic systems. So in that respect, how is my sense of that just romantic small-scale farming stuff, or is that an active part of the positive ecological effects of grazing, part of what is being developed here in the fiber shed concept?
Your vision, or what you're seeing in your home community, is indicative of all of what's happening in California related to the integration of wool-producing animals into croplands or rangelands. It's actually historically been a very good system because sheep were used to always, you know, mitigate fire danger by moving through, keeping meadows. And what we're realizing now in biogeochemistry is that grasslands, they pump a lot of atmospheric carbon into below ground storage, whereas above ground, you know, trees and shrubs, that's a lot of above ground carbon that you see manifested, but that above ground carbon burns very easily. And in a changing climate, that we're seeing that above ground carbon burn in mass. And so all that carbon gets re-emitted into the atmosphere. So sheep and ungulates in general, if managed well, just the way the herbivores like the elk and the pronghorn and the bison used to, they used to keep these prairies and meadows open. And these are places where photosynthetic capture through, you know, these perennial grasses would, again, draw down carbon into the soil versus the above ground biomass. And so grazing animals keep grasslands, and they keep a lot of carbon below ground where it's very safe and resilient against fire. But also those grasslands, if you graze them correctly and something called adaptive managed grazing, which is what you're seeing when an animal is moved along by a shepherd, that shepherd keeps moving them so that they have fresh grass, so that they don't eat where another animal has peed or pooped, because mm-hmm. you don't want parasite load in the animal. So you just keep moving them to keep everybody healthy, the grass healthy, the animal healthy. It's a very simple act, but there is so much going on from a carbon sequestration level there, and a fuel load reduction and a water holding capacity, a biological diversity. I mean, meadows and grasslands are part of the critical composition of California's oak woodlands. You need open grassland for so much that goes on ecologically. So sheep can and are a critical part of that ecosystem. Now, in modern context, right? Since European contact, we have sheep. But we've been able to work with them, I think, in ways that are very proactive and healthy, and we're seeing that enhanced now with our modern understanding of carbon.
Yeah, well, you know, you pay attention and you might actually learn something. Human beings can figure it out. I wanted to shift here and ask you about fiber and cotton in particular. Now, cotton, in my mind, has kind of a bad reputation in terms of its ecological impact, that it's very hard on soil. It's one of the things that cotton is famous for, but it makes me wonder now at this point whether that is simply a result of the practices that the exploitive practices, extractive practices that cotton production has had in the past, and how cotton, for instance, I will make a plug right now for an article that was in the last issue of Yes Magazine that talked about your work. And one of the things that interested me was that it mentioned a strain of cotton that's being developed that is colored. So if you could, how does the fiber shed concept work, the agroecological concepts work in terms of raising cotton in a more ecologically sane way?
It's true. Cotton has been very infographicked, I like to say. Every time,
yes.
You know, this t-shirt took 700 gallons of water. Yeah, there's a lot of extrapolated data from systems. And the reality of cotton is that everywhere I've seen it grown in the West, it's grown quite differently. And so it really requires, again, a regional understanding of one's community, how water is moved through the system to irrigate or not. Is it a rain-fed system? These are all questions that we who can consume cotton, because cotton is grown in the western United States, in New Mexico, yep. Arizona, California. We have quite a bit of it. And in California, 200 million pounds per year. Just generally, though, in the United States, above 95% of our cotton, at least in 2015, was genetically engineered cotton to withstand spraying with Roundup. So before we even get into the beautiful, nuanced, colored cotton rain-fed systems that I can talk about in a moment, I just want listeners to understand the very critical reality around the what we call the suicide gene that has been put into cotton, where, you know, farmers have to keep purchasing cotton seed to keep seed companies like Monsanto well funded, the co-selling of Roundup or other herbicides or pesticides, or the invasion of the genes so that you actually have a Lepidoptera species butterfly killing gene put into the cotton seed so that it can resist the bollworm. This is an issue that I take real concern with, that we're engineering species and we're not letting co-evolutionary processes take shape. And cotton is... Yes. Really the benchmark of where Monsanto got a foothold in the industry, because people were so concerned about ingesting GMOs, but they didn't care about wearing them. And so we lined the pockets of these companies, these genetically engineered companies, massively through our mass consumption of genetically engineered cotton. And this is how these companies got a foothold. So I really, really just want to draw people's attention to please purchase certified organic cotton. If you can't buy it from local sources, there's good reason for that at the moment. We don't have the mills and the value chains up and running. But just buy organic as a first step. And then within the nuances of place-based growing, the West Texas Organic Cotton Co-op is around 19,000-acre organic cotton co-op that has been on the land for multiple generations. A lot of what happens in West Texas is that they are reliant on monsoon rains. So a lot of dry farming occurs, meaning they rely on rainfall, not pumping water. So, and then you look to our Quepe Valley, where they're growing, Sally Fox is growing color grown cotton, Palo Verde green cotton, and Buffalo Brown cotton, and Sierra Red cotton. These are ancient varietals that she's brought back into genetic conversation by not engineering, but through what we call classical breeding. Sally Fox, the farmer, functions more like a bumblebee in the field. So there's very few classical breeders left in the world. She's one of them, and she's in California. And I highly recommend people support Sally Fox's cotton project. It is a gem on our planet. And she doesn't live far from many of us who are here in the Bay Area or anywhere in California. We're blessed. There's cotton grown with another project in Firebow, California, called the Sustainable Cotton Project, where they're avidly working with cotton growers on a 2,000-acre project to move them out of conventional practice into organic practices. And there's a lot of those producers are totally willing to move towards organic if the consumers will purchase those cotton harvests at the price point that those farmers need to substantiate organic methods.
We're almost out of time, but I have a question for you that has to do with designation of organic. Now, there's in food practices, there is an organization that does non-GMO certification. Is there a similar certification process available in the clothing fibers so that instead of organic, is there a non-GMO designation that for that narrowly focused issue is used on clothing, cloth fibers?
Currently, the place you can, if you don't have access to locally grown materials where you can trace them 100%,
yes,
you would want to look for GOTS, G-O-T-S, Global Organic Trade Certified, GOTS, GOTS is the international standard. And I would look for that to make sure you're not purchasing a genetically engineered cotton. Certified USDA organic cotton is not genetically engineered. There's still safety by looking for the organic label, but we at FiberShed have developed an agricultural co-op. So California has its first producer-owned co-op where we will be actually rebuilding these value chains more into the future and producing garments that you can be guaranteed are not tethered to anything that has been messing with the genetic code in that way, where you're, you know, resequencing DNA and or engineering DNA from one species to another. That's out of my threshold of okayness.
Well, Rebecca, this has been utterly delightful and extremely informative, and I'm sure listeners have been as thrilled as I am to be able to talk to you. So, Rebecca Burgess from the organization FiberShed, thank you very much for your time today and for your work. Can you please tell listeners where they can learn more?
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. This has been a pleasure, and listeners can go to our website, www.fibershed.org. We're on Instagram at FiberShed, Facebook, FiberShed, Facebook page. And again, I just admonish everyone to use those channels as a vessel to connect directly with farmers and artists in their community.
Thanks again, and take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for information about this show and almost 700 other shows, free access to recordings as downloads, all of them, a free newsletter about upcoming shows, and more. It's all at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeffrey Fawcett. Being informed not only protects your health and your environment, it protects your freedom.